Welcome, everybody, for this Zoom-only seminar. This week will be the last one at 11 a.m. in the morning. Starting from next week, we'll try to hello, hey, to do the Cafe Club always on Wednesday, but in early afternoon at 2 p.m. The speaker today is Devon Powell. Postdoc at the Max Planck Institute of Astrophysics in Göttingen since 2018, since more than 4 years. Devon started his studies in at the Arizona State University, then moving to Stanford for the PhD, right, where he was associated to the Kavli Institute there, and then he moved to Germany for the postdoc, and now he's working the group or with Simona Vegetti, right? Well, that's all. I invite everyone to interrupt Devon to ask questions at any time. Please, Devon, we don't see your screen. It's fully blank now. Oh no, it's fine. Great. Thank
Okay, and
you.
does it change when
Perfect.
I? Okay, great.
No, it's not changing now. Yes, okay.
Okay, so
Fine.
maybe there's a slight delay. Okay, thank you for the nice introduction, Carlo. So yes, I'm want this to be fairly informal. So if anything is very unclear, feel free to speak up. And I'll also note that this is the first talk in which I've presented this work. So you guys are sort of my guinea pig audience for presenting this particular project. So I'll be happy to take any helpful comments or questions about it. So like Carlo said, I'm working in Simona Vegetti's group at MPA, and this project is also in collaboration with John McKean, a radio astronomer in Groningen, as well as Simon White, Elisa Ferreira, Simon May, and Christiana Spingola. So I'll start off with some background slides to sort of lay the groundwork for what exactly it is we're trying to do here. So as I'm sure all of you are familiar, we're trying to work out which is the correct model for dark matter. And on large scales, we think that cold dark matter essentially works very well. It describes the clustering of galaxies and galaxy clusters, and we see phenomenological evidence like galaxy rotation curves and the Bullitt cluster. But there's still some room on small scales for models that may not be exactly like cold dark matter. So depending on the population of subhalos that we expect to see in a galaxy, or the number of satellite galaxies, or the core versus cusp that may exist in the center of a dark matter halo, this is where some different types of dark matter models may arise. So on the left hand, I've just shown a picture of cold dark matter where you expect to see a large subhalo population. In warm dark matter, where you have a large free streaming length that suppresses substructure formation at low masses, you end up with many fewer very low mass substructures. You also have, for instance, self-interacting dark matter, where there's a non-zero cross-section for collisions between dark matter particles. And in this instance, you end up with a flat density profile near the center of massive halos. The model that I'm interested in for this work is called fuzzy dark matter. And in this model, you have very, very light particles, so on the order of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. And you end up with some very interesting phenomenology for fuzzy dark matter. So in this talk, we'll be using a radio observation of a gravitationally lensed radio jet to probe for the existence of some of these features that are inherent in fuzzy dark matter models. So I'll zoom in on this picture on the right-hand side. This is from a set of simulations by Shiva in 2014. So this is from their Nature paper, and it was really the first time that somebody had managed to successfully simulate a fuzzy dark matter cosmology encompassing all of the relevant spatial scales. So, like I said just before, fuzzy dark matter is a class of ultralight dark matter particles. And the ultralight particle was originally motivated by the mass of the QCD axion, But some of the features that arise in fuzzy dark matter halos may explain some sub-galaxy scale phenomena better than CDM. And this is an active area of research. The most generic prediction in fuzzy dark matter, though, is that because the particle is so light, you get a de Broglie wavelength that's on the order of kiloparsecs. So you get essentially astrophysical size quantum behaviors out of the fuzzy dark matter particle. So there are some observational consequences of this. One of them is that you have a suppression of the halo mass function at low masses. So this is similar to the suppression that happens in warm dark matter, but it comes from a completely different physical mechanism. So whereas in warm dark matter, you suppress the halo mass function via free streaming, in fuzzy dark matter, it's a result of what you can term as quantum pressure, let's say. And this same quantum pressure effect gives you core density profiles in halos. So this is noticeable observationally in dwarf galaxies. So there have been a few studies trying to constrain fuzzy dark matter models this way. And then probably the most generic prediction of fuzzy dark matter is that you get these granules, which are due to wave interference in the main dark matter halos. So this is what this figure illustrates. So if you look at this most highly zoomed in figure, you'll see that you get this soliton core, which we're actually not interested in lensing because it's typically much smaller than the Einstein radius of the lens. But what we are interested in are these granule density structures that result purely from wave interference patterns. So these are the features that we'll actually be looking for in the gravitational lens data. So I'll move on to a couple of slides just to illustrate how gravitational lensing lets us probe the mass distribution in the dark matter halo. And I want to be clear that in
I'm
this
sorry,
slide,
Devin.
Sorry?
We see the slide with title background fuzzy dark matter. Not okay, that's fine.
Good, this okay. Great. So I'll be clear that in this slide, I'm showing you a picture of a gravitational lens that's being perturbed by a cold dark matter or warm dark matter subhalo. And just to get ahead of any confusion, this is just to illustrate what type of effect we're looking for in a gravitational lens. But in this talk, I'm not talking about warm dark matter or cold dark matter. This is just to illustrate the gravitational perturbation to an arc. So here we see a mock observation of a gravitational lens. So we have a very long arc that's stretched out from three images of this source and then a counter image, over on the right-hand side. And when I click forward in the slide, if you look at this white rectangle on the left of the plot, you can see that when I place a subhalo or a perturbation along the arc, then it actually leaves us with a detectable signature. So I'll just click back and forth a couple of times. So this is just to illustrate the types of effects that we can see. And this is what a lot of people do in gravitational lensing studies, testing cold dark matter versus warm dark matter models, is to look for these types of perturbations along the arcs that are due to a single subhalo or line of sight halo. Now, a main effect or one of the observational effects that really determines our sensitivity to low mass dark structures. And by low mass dark structures, I mean subhalos in warm dark matter or cold dark matter, or in this case, granule structures in fuzzy dark matter, is the angular resolution of the observation. So I have a few observations of the same lens system. Here on the lower left, we have an HST observation with roughly 150 milliarc second resolution. Keck adaptive optics, where you get something like 70 milliarc seconds. This third one is EELT. This is a mock data because the telescope obviously doesn't exist yet. And then you have very long baseline interferometry. So this is a type of radio observing technique where, depending on the frequency, you can get very, very good angular resolution down to something like 5 milliarcseconds. And you get these very long, thin arcs, which are really, really sensitive to the presence of low mass structures. So this image down in the lower right-hand corner of this slide shows you, in the warm dark matter paradigm, for instance, you could potentially see perturbations from subhalos down to 10 to the 6 solar masses, which really pushes down our limits for these types of models. And we'll see in the rest of this talk that for fuzzy dark matter, this is also a key aspect of this work, that we're really leveraging the angular resolution of VLBI observations. So I'll give you some background as well on radio interferometry for those of you who aren't so familiar with it. In radio interferometry, we don't have a single antenna or a single dish or a single mirror telescope. What we actually do is have a set of radio antenna that are spread across some distance from each other. So for very long baseline interferometry, we actually have antennas that are all over the globe. So the spacings between antennas, or what we term baselines in interferometry, are roughly the scale of the Earth. And each pair of antennas measures a so-called visibility on the sky. So each pair of antennas sees a Fourier component of the sky. In other words, the response of the instrument, or the collective response of all the dishes once you correlate their signals, is to take the Fourier transform of the sky brightness. Okay, so maybe I need to click twice to do this properly. Great. So here's a schematic that I hope now all of you can see. So we have this set of radio antenna, and they're all looking at the same gravitationally lensed image, which is over on this right-hand side. And the response of the instrument is a Fourier transform. So this is analogous to the point spread function of an optical instrument. So this all becomes a part of the forward modeling process. So we have some model for the source, which is then passed through a model for the gravitational lens. From that, we obtain a sky model. So that's what this gravitationally lensed arc would look like. And then the instrument takes a Fourier transform of it. And that's the model data that we're working with. The key point of this, though, is that when we synthesize an image using a radio interferometer, the observing wavelength and the distance between the antennas determines our angular resolution in the usual way. So for this instrument, which we've used for the observation that I'll describe in this talk, we have an angular resolution of something like 5 milliarcseconds. Okay, so if the slide has changed, you should be looking at an image of a gravitational lens with some very nice long extended arcs here. And this is the gravitational lens system that I'll actually be discussing in the talk. This data set was observed by John McKean, and then Christiana Spingola did the initial data reduction and some basic modeling of it. It is a gravitationally lensed radio jet. One of the nice features of these gravitational lens systems that are radio bright is that you get these really long extended arcs that are very thin. So like I said, they're very sensitive to the presence of dark structures in the lens. And another nice thing that you get for free is that the lens galaxy typically does not emit in the observing frequency. So you don't have to do any type of lens light subtraction. You just get the lens arcs in the observation, which is very nice. So in this observation, our angular resolution is 5 milliarcseconds. So that's really, really good. That's sort of state of the art for gravitational lens observations. So with all that background out of the way, I'll move on to the work that I've been actually doing with this data set. So from this data, I've managed to actually make a forward modeling pipeline in which we have a pixelated source model. as well as a joint inference of the mass distribution in the lens. So this was a big, long project that I did during my first couple of years here at MPA. And it allows us, using this joint inference with the pixelated source and the gravitational lens, to do Bayesian inference on the mass model itself. The first time that I applied this to the data was doing a smooth parametric modeling of the lens. So we're looking at basically an elliptical power law density profile, plus some multipole perturbations, plus some external terms that describe a Taylor expansion of the potential around the lens itself. So you can see that, let me describe what you're looking at here. So in the left-hand panel on this lower left, we have a convergence map. So this is the surface mass density of the gravitational lens. And the arcs are overlaid in these black contours. In the center panel, I've shown you the reconstructed sky image of the lens. So this is the surface brightness of the sky. And in these yellow contours, this is a Keck adaptive optics observation of the same lens. And finally, in the lower right-hand panel, we have the reconstructed source model. So this is what the source light looks like before it's gravitationally lensed and observed with the interferometer. And you can see very clearly that we have a radio jet. So we have several of these bright emission knots in the lens. And here is the reconstructed infrared light from the galaxy. So we can see that we probably have some relativistic beaming of this side of the radio jet towards us, and then a not so bright component down in the lower right. So I'll point out that the smooth model for this lens actually works surprisingly well for this lens. So we don't actually need a lot of substructure in the lens, it would seem, in order to recover this nice focus source model. So before I describe the results, I'll recap the fuzzy dark matter. So what we're looking for are something like these granule structures, which are wave interference in the dark matter halo of the lens. And in order to do this type of search, this type of inference on the radio data, we need a way to generate many, many realizations of a fuzzy dark matter lens that describes this data. And this actually turns out to be fairly straightforward to do. So there's a nice paper from Chan et al. That describes in an analytic way what the density profile of a fuzzy dark matter lens should look like. So they basically use some quantum mechanics arguments with some generic potential well to tell you in terms of a Gaussian random field, what should these fuzzy dark matter perturbations look like on top of the smooth lens. So what we start with in the bottom panel here is a composite lens model. So we fitted this to the observation. We have a dark matter halo described by a power law, and we have some baryons that we describe using a Sursuch profile. So you can see that the Sursuch profile is fit very nicely to the lens light in the infrared observation. And together they make some total smooth lens profile. When we add in granule structures, so when we turn this dark matter halo into a fuzzy dark matter halo, we end up with these granule perturbations in the gravitational lens. So these are now projected into 2D, and you can see that they really do perturb the gravitational landscape of the lens. So if you're familiar with the mathematics behind gravitational lensing, these white curves here are the critical curves that describe a surface of infinite magnification in the lens. And you can see that they cross over the lensed arc many, many times. And so this is kind of the main thing that will help us to probe whether or not this lens actually contains a fuzzy dark matter halo or not. And if so, what is the lower bound on the mass that you can support in this lens? So if anything here is unclear, because I know I've been moving through this fairly quickly, I'll describe the inference method and then show you the results. But I just want to make sure that everybody understands exactly what type of signal we're looking for in this gravitational lens. Okay, great. So there's four basic steps to the inference process here. The first is that we compute a likelihood. So this comes out of my original work in developing this Bayesian modeling pipeline. And I'm not going to spend any time on it, really. All I will say about it is that given a mass model for the gravitational lens and a statistical prior for the source, which we're fairly confident in, as well as the data, it will return a likelihood or a number that essentially describes how well does this lens model fit the data, or how well does the lens model describe the data that we're observing. So now into the lens model, we're adding these realizations of fuzzy dark matter halos instead of just some smooth parametric model. And the model for the fuzzy dark matter halo is described by a few parameters. So in this likelihood, we have D, which are the data, which are interferometric visibilities. We have the particle mass. So the particle mass sets the de Broglie wavelength of the perturbations. This should be a lowercase f with a subscript, like so. We have a dark matter fraction in the lens, which effectively sets the normalization or the overall smoothness of the lens, because only the dark matter in the lens exhibits these fuzzy dark matter granules. We have the velocity dispersion of the dark matter in the lens, which is effectively a proxy for the depth of the gravitational potential. And then we have the smooth lens model parameters, as well as a hyperparameter that describes the regularization strength for the source model. Now, a key part of this inference is that a given lens velocity dispersion, particle mass, and dark matter fraction can describe an infinite number of configurations of this wave field in the lens. So we have to go to some sort of random sampling technique in order to make constraints on the fuzzy dark matter, because this is not a deterministic model for the lens. This is just a way of generating random realizations of fuzzy dark matter halos in this lens. So we generate around 40,000 of these lens realizations in the end for this inference, and we have some statistical priors that are well-motivated from our observations and from the previous smooth modeling, as well as from HST photometry of this lens. And so we evaluate likelihoods for all of these samples, and we place an acceptance criteria on each sample, that for a sample to be accepted, it has to be above the 3 sigma contours of the baseline smooth model. So in other words, for one of these fuzzy dark matter lens realizations to be accepted, it has to explain the data at least as well as the worst 0.3% of the samples in the smooth model posterior distribution. So this is intentionally a very conservative acceptance criterion for these samples. And finally, we build up a histogram of accepted samples to get an empirical posterior on the mass of the fuzzy dark matter particle. So in this way, we automatically marginalize over the nuisance parameters, which are the smooth lens parameters, the dark matter fraction, the velocity dispersion in the lens. And in that way, we arrive at a posterior. So I have 3 more slides remaining, so I think that my timing is going to work out rather well. So in this plot, I'm just giving you 4 examples of realizations of fuzzy dark matter lenses. And they're ranked from left to right in order of increasing particle mass. And this, the purpose of this is just to illustrate the effect that introducing a fuzzy dark matter halo into the lens has on the observation. So on the very left-hand panel, we have a very light or relatively light fuzzy dark matter particle, 3×10^-22 EV. And you can see that the reconstructed source looks really crazy. So there's a lot of caustic crossings that zigzag back and forth across the source. And in an attempt to fit the observed data, given this lens model, it comes up with this really crazy source that's obviously unphysical, and it gets very heavily penalized by the log likelihood. As we move to the right, you can see that as the particle mass increases, the de Broglie wavelength decreases, and this effect becomes less and less pronounced. So at around 1.5 times 10 to the minus 21, you still have a lot of wiggles in the caustic curve and a very somewhat disrupted source. It looks fairly well focused by eye, but the likelihood is still strongly penalizing it. And as we move to lighter and lighter particle masses, essentially once we get to around 10 to the minus 20 EV, the model cannot distinguish between a fuzzy dark matter lens and a completely smooth lens model. And I've plotted the delta log likelihood. So these are a measure or the amount by which one of these fuzzy dark matter lens realizations is above or below the acceptance threshold in the likelihood. So until we get to very relatively high fuzzy dark matter masses, we're essentially rejecting most of these samples. So this is how we build up an empirical posterior. And this is the result here. So this black curve is the posterior odds ratio. So to give you a little background on this measure, what we've done here is taken a ratio between the posterior that we measure in the fuzzy dark matter model and then divide it by the posterior that we get for a completely smooth model. So this is a way of comparing the fuzzy dark matter and the smooth model in terms of their relative odds as a function of particle mass. And the reason we do it this way is that we're placing a lower bound. So unlike, say, a Gaussian distribution, where you have a very well-defined and square integrable distribution function, here we have a distribution that extends infinitely off in one direction. So it's impossible for us to place, say, a formal confidence interval like 2 or 3 sigma in a Gaussian equivalent. So instead, we place our bound in terms of the odds ratio relative to the smooth model. And a typical value for this is to do a 20 to 1 posterior odds ratio, which in some sense is roughly equivalent to a 2 sigma lower bound. So in our work, we place a 4.4 times 10 to the 21 lower mass bound on the fuzzy dark matter particle. And that's this lower bound here. So you can see that if we trace it down to the curve, this is at the 20 to 1 level. So this is where this curve crosses 5% relative to the posterior of the smooth model. Alongside it, I plotted some other lower bounds for fuzzy dark matter for the particle mass. Nadler et al. Looks at Milky Way satellite galaxies. Banach et al. Look at stellar streams in the Milky Way. LaRoche et al. Is another gravitational lensing. They do not look at extended sources, though. They're looking at, I think, a sample of 11 systems with gravitationally lensed quasars. So they're looking at flux ratio anomalies in lensed point sources. Rogers is looking at Lyman Alpha. So this is a cosmological observation. And then Marsh et al. In 2019, their lower bound is around 10 to the minus 19. And they're looking at tidal heating of the stellar population in ultralight or ultra faint dwarf galaxies. So this is another very interesting probe for the fuzzy dark matter particle mass as well. So the point of this plot is to present our result, but also to show that from this one gravitational lens observation, the combination of these long, thin extended arcs and the very high angular resolution of the observation gives us a very high level of sensitivity to the presence of fuzzy dark matter granules in the lens. So from this one single observation, we can place competitive constraints on the particle mass relative to a lot of other observational probes. And that's all I have to say about it. So to summarize a few of my points, I've just put some bullet points up here. A very interesting prospect for the future is that the Square Kilometer Array is expected to discover around 10,000 lenses in the radio. And we therefore expect many of them to be radio bright lenses that can be followed up with VLBI at this resolution, and that will contain very long extended arcs that will be good for this type of analysis. So in the next 5 to 10 years, we expect there to be a lot more of these types of lenses that are really, really sensitive for these types of dark matter model probes, whereas we only have a handful at the moment. And then the next step is to work on warm dark matter with this lens system. And that's something that's currently ongoing. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll take your questions now.
Thank you very much, Devon. Wonderful talk. I have at least a couple of questions, but before, is there anyone wish to ask or comment? Well, I start. If I understand correctly, given the small value of the mass, there's no hope to have other instruments than very long baseline interferometry or ELT to be able to detect with a single lens. To have signatures of fuzzy dark matter, isn't it?
That's correct. I think ELT will have the sensitivity to do it because they have roughly the same angular resolution. But for looking at resolved sources, then for an instrument like Keck AO or Hubble Space Telescope, you really would not be able to achieve a lower bound at this mass, let's say.
I see. Another curiosity before Eric, how long is the observing time for VLBI, and how difficult is to have observing time with VLBI for this kind of science and systems?
This observation was taken over 18 hours, so it's a fairly dedicated time. So you'd have to essentially write a proposal for the single observation. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Eric, please.
Yes, hello. So, yeah, thank you. It was very impressive. Nice talk. Lot of work. I was wondering, for this ELT image, which instrument did you simulate, you know?
This is something that Simona did. So I'm not entirely sure exactly like what point spread function she used, if that's what you're asking.
What point spread function or?
I think that this is something like a 3 milliarc second PSF.
Yeah, that's...
But I really don't know. I got this figure from her, so this was really just to illustrate the angular resolution.
Oh, okay.
Is it published or to be submitted?
As far as I know, no. So Simona is on the side sort of working on doing gravitational lens modeling for extended sources with a very high resolution optical instrument. And it's actually proving to be quite difficult because you resolve a lot of structure in the source. Fitting a lens model to this, it's sort of analogous to like lens modeling with galaxy clusters, where it gets really complicated once you can see a lot of very small features in the lens light.
Yeah, but then in your case with the VLBI observations, do you it seems also that you observe some features in the arc.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's a help, right?
Yeah, we have some features. And surprisingly, I mean, it was to my surprise, using a a fairly smooth parametric model, we're able to actually get a sorcery construction that looks very nice. So this is kind of the question is, you know, how do we push this further and quantify this result? Because evaluating one of these likelihoods takes like 30 seconds on a GPU. And in the business of doing machine learning or MCMC sampling, this is still fairly expensive to do. So the reason that we did the fuzzy dark matter analysis first is that it is relatively robust when you compare it to doing like a warm dark matter analysis, let's say. So to get back to your original question, it's nice to have some structure. So we have a few bright spots along the arc that we can clearly identify with their counter images, and that helps inform the lens modeling. But with something like this ELT image, if you have, you know, some star forming clumps in a galaxy or things like that, that you have to lens model over a large area and get a model that works over a large area, not just for a very thin arc, then it becomes a bit more difficult. So I don't know if that helps to answer your question or if I've just helped to confuse everyone a little bit more.
Oh no, that's nice.
Are you planning to observe all the systems?
In this slide, you mean?
No, in general, I guess.
In general, other systems. At the moment, no. And the reason for that is that at the moment, there are only a handful of these types of systems. So there's JO751, which is the system that we did the analysis on here. There's B1938, which is this lens system here. So the VLBI observation here, we actually expect to be even more sensitive to low mass structures because unlike the radio jet that I've talked about in this talk, this lens system contains a very, very compact radio source that just happens to sit right on top of the caustic in the source plane. So it gets stretched out into this super smooth featureless arc. So we expect this to be very sensitive to the presence of substructures, but it's proving very difficult to make a good mass model for it. So at the moment, we're kind of doing these lens systems ad hoc, you know, on a case-by-case basis. They're very difficult to discover is another issue. So discovering lensed radio bright systems is difficult in itself. So there's, for instance, the ALMA dusty star-forming galaxies, which have some other spectral features that help you to identify gravitational lenses. But in the radio, like for a jet or a quasar, you expect some more featureless kind of power law-like spectrum that doesn't really help you when you're looking for gravitational lenses. So this is why I brought up SKA at the very end, is because it's going to be a much better survey tool, and you should be able to find a lot more gravitationally lensed radio sources in those data that you can then follow up. So at the moment, we have plenty of work cut out for us for the existing handful of gravitational lenses. And hopefully by modeling a lot of these with a lot of hand tuning, we'll learn a lot as well about the data and, you know, be able to make these pipelines more streamlined for the future.
I had a technical question. So in LensTool, we were wondering at some point whether using visibility plane or the reconstructed image plane of the this one that you show. So what is your opinion about this, because you have done everything in visibility plane apparently, right?
Yeah, correct. So the main effort? Sorry,
is it worth the effort?
Is it
worth
To do the image plane.
Not to do the visibility, the fit in the visibility plane.
Is it worse in what sense?
But in the sense that it costs more time to for you transform to the visibility space.
So if you, for every likelihood evaluation, you actually do this non-uniform Fourier transform back and forth from the visibility space, then it is very, very expensive. Maybe I don't have the slide for this here. But it turns out, so if you read the previous paper on this analysis, there are some linear algebra tricks that allow you to phrase the visibility space inference in terms of the dirty image and the dirty beam. So you can do a whole likelihood evaluation using just FFT pairs between a gridded visibility space and the image space. So there's some effective dimensionality reduction that you can do that is still mathematically equivalent to doing it directly in the visibility space, if that makes sense.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm. There is a trick.
There is a trick.
Okay. Good to know.
Marceau, please.
Thank you. Well, thanks for this talk, impressive system. A curiosity about fuzzy dark matter model, you mentioned that it generates cores, kiloparsec scale. And I was wondering what happens on galaxy cluster scale.
Mm-hmm.
Generate cores and of which typical size?
Well, for cluster scale, you would not see a core in the cluster itself, because you're on much, much larger spatial scales than the wavelength of the dark matter particle. So the fuzzy dark matter phenomenology is really limited to smaller scale things like subhalo population and the core cusp problem.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments, curiosities? Well, if not, we are, I would say, perfectly on time. So let me thank you, Devon, again, for your participation. I take this opportunity to advertise the next week coffee clubs. It will be two coffee clubs. An extra coffee club on the Monday. Japanese PhD student visiting Denis Hiro Yumeda, talking about probing cosmic realization sources and history with large scale surveys. And the regular cafe club on Wednesday at 2 p.m. by Silvia Martocchia, talking about the origin of global clusters and the anomalous stellar populations. Thank you again, and see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you.